fertilizer nor lawnmower since sometime last century. Front steps, rickety and rotting, lead to a porch littered with trash and a ripped brown sofa, where three raggedy men drink from paper bags. If it weren't for them and the hooker advertising her wares from a second-story balcony, I'd think the place was abandoned. I stand on the sidewalk thinking through my options. I could cut my losses and leave. I could march to the door and demand my money back. I could suck it up and stay. The men eye me from the front porch, and I know how they see me. The rusty Buick with Oklahoma plates, the soccer mom shirt, my fried hair. I'm the naive country girl come to the big city. I'm an easy target. The hooker calls down to me.
Hey, Blondie, you looking for this?
She pulls her tube top down to reveal breasts as enormous as the fat rolls holding them up. She jiggles them back and forth like a bowl of caramel pudding.
No thanks, I say. I'm good.
She barks a phlegmy laugh, and she's not wrong. Beth is going to have to work on her one-liners. I drop into my car and motor away. Around the corner, I squeeze my car into a spot at the edge of a crowded parking lot. After the car, the hotels, the food, Nick's fee and debit card, I have just over $2,000 in cash left. Tens and twenties mostly, siphoned from grocery funds, birthday and Christmas money, forgotten bills swiped from your pockets when you were passed out. Saving was a long, laborious process that took me almost a year to do in a way that you wouldn't notice. I bought things on discount and shop sales. I switched to cheaper toilet paper, coffee, washing powder. Ironically, I stopped cutting my hair. My stash of money grew slowly, deliberately. Anything else would have gotten me killed. But $2,000 won't last long, not even with a strict budget. Hotels are expensive, and most require ID. Even if I got a job tomorrow, staying in one would blow through my cash. For a city of 6 million souls, Atlanta has an astonishing lack of beds for abused or homeless women, of which I am both. I could sleep in my car, but it doesn't feel safe, and I probably wouldn't do much sleeping. A better option would be to find another lodge, one that is cheap and won't ask for identification, like the ones I found before settling on Wiley, rooming in boarding houses, a hostel or two, some seriously sketchy motels. If only I remembered their names. And no, I didn't write any of them down. I couldn't. If you'd found anything even remotely suspicious, the search parameters on my laptop, a new number on my phone log, a faraway address scribbled on the back of a receipt, you would have confronted me. That was the hardest part of this past year, staying one step ahead of you. I'm reaching for the burner phone to start my new search when I spot a sign at the far end of the lot for a Best Buy. Best Buy means computers, banks and banks of computers, the internet at my fingers, free and with no tracking, unlike the data on this piece of crap prepaid phone. I crank the key and head farther up the lot. The store is packed for a Thursday morning, people everywhere, jamming the aisles and forming lines a dozen people deep at the MacBook's display. I push past them to a lonely, unmanned Dell at the end of the counter. I navigate to the internet and pause, stare at the blinking cursor, check behind me to make sure no one is watching. Old habits are hard to break. 2 seconds later, I'm typing in the address for Pine Bluff's local news website. I hold my breath and scroll through the headlines. Arkansas man accused of killing wife for changing TV channel. State police investigate Monticello murder. Pine Bluff officer shot in ambush attack. Nothing about a missing woman. Nothing about me. And yet I've been gone for almost 24 hours now. Why is there nothing on the internet? Is the police department sitting on the story? Are they holding out on the press? Or has the media just not sniffed it out yet? The Pine Bluff Police Department website doesn't make me any wiser. Their homepage is as generic as ever, the last item on a long list of to-dos for the department, updated almost as an afterthought. The most recent post on their newsroom page is from 2016. On a whim, I surf to Facebook. And I'm in luck. Gary Minoff, a middle-aged man from Conyers, Georgia, forgot to sign out. No one will think anything of him nosing around on the Pine Bluff Police Department Facebook page, which is much more current than their website. I scrolled down their wall, past posts about robberies, murders, a deadly hit and run, and the knot between my shoulder blades tightens. Maybe something happened and you haven't yet figured out I'm gone. Maybe I have more of a head start than I think. I can't decide if the old adage applies here. Is no news really good news? "Best price laptop in the place," a voice says from right behind me. A ginger with facial hair and a Best Buy polo. He gestures to the Dell.
"Intel Pentium dual-core processor, 2 megabyte cache, up to 2.3 gigahertz performance. All that and more for only $349.
I have no idea what any of that means. I give him a smile that is polite but perfunctory. "I'm just looking, thanks."
"For a few bucks more, you can upgrade, tack on some more memory, or some cloud-based backup storage."
"I just want to play around a little more, try things out. Maybe if you come back in 10 minutes or so, I'll be ready to decide." Or maybe by the time you come back, I'll be gone. He wanders off to bother another customer, and I exit out of Facebook. Time to get busy. I Google cheapest boarding houses, Atlanta, and take a picture of the results with my burner phone, then do the same for area hostels. Just in case, I find 5 hotels advertising rooms under $50 a night, and take a picture of those as well. The rest of the time I use for poking around on Craigslist. Most of the housing listings are either too expensive or too creepy. A dollar for a living girlfriend? Pass. I click on one of the cheapest listings, a furnished basement bedroom in a house in Collier Heights. Then back out of the page when I see the field labeled driver's license number. I click on the next one. For professional ladies only.
"My girlfriend got totally shafted on Craigslist."
It's the ginger sales clerk again, hovering behind me even though it's been nowhere near 10 minutes.
"She'd booked a room with what she thought was a nice family, but it was a scam. She gets there, and some crazy dude pulls a gun on her, and next thing she knows, she's got no money, no wallet, no car, no nothing."
"That's awful." He shoves his hands in his pockets and grins, revealing a row of neat white teeth.
"I'll say. 3 months later, she's at the courthouse, declaring herself bankrupt. Bastard stole her identity, then took out all sorts of loans and credit cards in her name. By the time she figured out what was happening, he'd racked up over $50,000 of debt in her name. It's going to take her years to get her credit back on track. Anyway, all that goes to say, you might want to be careful."
His gaze wanders to the picture on the laptop screen. And he's not wrong. This place is a dump. I click the X to close the screen. He starts in on his sales pitch again, something about a LED backlit screen, an HD camera, and I'm about to tell him to back off when something occurs to me. His girlfriend's wallet was stolen. Some asshole took her credit cards, her driver's license, everything. Even if she went to the DMV that very same day, it would have taken her a couple of days, maybe a week, to get her new plastic. My voice is a lot more friendly when I turn back to the salesman. "Where did your girlfriend stay in the meantime, after that guy took off with her wallet, I mean?"
"Oh, well, she couch surfed and stayed with me for a while, until she found this sweet boarding house over on the west side. Most places want some kind of credit card number as a guarantee, but this boarding house was cool with her paying cash, especially after she told them her sob story."
I realize this is only the first hurdle of many. I have no home, no ID, no more than a couple grand to my name. But I have a sob story, one that's so much sadder than this guy's girlfriend's. And I have something even better. Determination. The smile that sneaks up my cheeks is genuine. Do you remember the boarding house name?
Jeffrey. The man on the other side of my door is not in uniform, but everything about him screams cop. Dark pants, pressed button-down shirt, his soldier's stance, and the gun strapped to a hip. Behind him on the driveway, an unmarked sedan ticks off the heat. He flashes a badge. Detective Marcus Durand, Pine Bluff PD. I understand you have some concerns about your wife. His voice is low, his words businesslike. I search him for even a hint of concern, but I can't find anything beyond a weary intensity. I swing the door wide and step back. Thanks for coming. My tone is thick with sarcasm, because I've been waiting for hours, 6 of them at least, trying to get some rest on the couch despite Ingrid standing above me, huffing like an angry dragon. The longer he kept us waiting, the harder she stomped on the floor, poking me on the shoulder every half hour to ask how it was possible for me to sleep. I just lie down and close my eyes, I told her. Maybe you should try it. If the detective hears the snark in my voice, he doesn't acknowledge it. He's younger than me, mid-30s maybe, and half a foot taller. He fills my foyer with his presence and size, making me feel small in my jeans and bare feet. I wish I'd changed into something nicer. I wish I had on some shoes. His jaw is set with the gravity of the situation. A missing woman, an after-hours house call, means he's taking this seriously. But not seriously enough to show up on time. He looks around, his gaze pausing on the curved staircase, the custom newels with vertical slats, the antique Turkish rug under his feet, none of which he can afford on a detective's salary. None of which I could have afforded either, were it not for Sabine. I consider telling him my wife made the $1 million club 4 years running, and that when it comes to decor, she knows how to get the best bang for your buck. But then his gaze lands on Ingrid, standing at the doorway to the kitchen. Something's wrong, she said, her voice high and tight. In the light of day, I notice her sneakers are mismatched, one black, the other blue, both of them untied. Something is terribly wrong. I just know it. And you are? Ingrid Stanfield, Sabine's sister. She juts a thumb into the next room. I've made some notes. They're in the kitchen. Detective Durand shifts his weight, but his shoes stay planted to the hardwood. He turns to me, pulling a notepad from the front pocket of his pants. I understand your wife didn't return home last night. I give him a perfunctory nod. Sabine had a late showing, something that happens fairly often these days. She's a real estate broker, a really good one. She texted me earlier in the day that she would be home by 9, but she never showed up. I've called her multiple times. Her phone rings, but it keeps sending me to voicemail. I've called her too, Ingrid says, nodding. I've been calling her all night. Can you maybe trace her cell phone? I'm worried she's had an accident, that she's hurt somewhere and needs help. Detective Marcus checks the time, by now closing in on 9 in the morning, and he looks as exhausted as I feel, drooping shoulders and pale-lined face. I'm guessing this is the end of his shift, and not the beginning. Could she have gone anywhere else? He says, in a tone that's a tad too calm. He sounds like he's holding back a sigh, or maybe a yawn, maybe both. To a friend's or family member's house? Or maybe grabbed a drink with someone and forgotten to tell you. I open my mouth to tell him no, but yet again Ingrid beats me to it. Sabine is too responsible to stay out all night without calling, and she always calls me back. Always. It's how I know something has happened to her. Something bad. I turn to the detective with a pained smile. Ingrid is right to be worried, I'm afraid. It's unlike Sabine to not let one of us know where she is. Their father is dead, and their mother is in assisted living over at Oakmont. The only other place she would have gone is to her sister's. Have one of you called over to Oakmont, just to be sure? I have, Ingrid said. One of the nurses spoke to her on the phone yesterday, but the others haven't seen or heard from her in days. The detective flips to a fresh sheet in his pad, writes Oakmont across the top in all caps. He points to the kitchen, where the lights are still burning despite the early morning sunshine. Maybe we could sit down? Of course, of course. I sweep an arm toward the doorway like Vanna fucking White. In the kitchen, Ingrid makes a beeline to the table, parking herself on the same chair as before, her back to the wall, her hands folded on her notepad. Detective Duran chooses my chair, the one at the head. The man used to being in charge. Detective, can I offer you something to drink? I think I have some Coke in the fridge, or I can make a pot of coffee if you'd like. I'll admit the offer is not entirely unselfish. Last night's pizza has resulted in a ferocious thirst, and it's probably not a bad idea to demonstrate I am both helpful and forthcoming. So far, he hasn't said anything to indicate he might suspect me, but he's also not said very much. I'll have a water, Ingrid says, and I glare at her over the detective's head. Did either of you call any of your wife's friends before you called the police? He says. Her colleagues? I pull three glasses from the cabinet by the sink. It was the middle of the night. I didn't want to wake anyone up. And I am certain my wife wouldn't go to their houses anyway. She'd go to her sister's. Jeffrey and I don't agree on much, but he's right. Sabine and I talk multiple times a day. I know her schedule. She would have come to me, and she would have told me if she was going anywhere else. That's why this is so urgent. The detective looks at her with new interest. Not, I sense, because of her conviction some awful disaster has overcome her sister, but because of her first words, the ones that imply she and I don't get along. She rips the top few pages from the notepad and holds them across the table. The names and numbers of everybody I could think of who might know Sabine's schedule yesterday. I left messages with everyone I got through to. I also wrote down Sabine's description, the make and model of her car, her email, and cell phone number. If you give me your number, I can text you her picture. Detective Duran takes a few seconds to scan the pages, then looks up with a nod. This is all very helpful, ma'am. A great start. His voice is as earnest as his expression, and I get the sudden and sinking feeling that Ingrid is showing me up, making me look unprepared, that I'm uncaring when I'm anything but. I'm the one who sounded the alarm in the first place. Leave it to Ingrid to make me feel defensive in my own house, which, she so kindly pointed out, is actually Sabine's. Leave it to her to make me feel like a bum, a mooch. It's always the husband, especially one like me, sexually frustrated and financially dependent. It wouldn't take much digging to uncover our marital issues. Ingrid knows. How long until she tells the detective? I fill the glasses with water from the tap, a sudden surge to seem cooperative. So what now? What's next? You mentioned she had a showing. Where was it? What time? I don't know, I say, only that she said she'd be home by 9. Ingrid's eyes hold mine for a second too long. The showing was at 7:30? She turns to the detective. Sabine is the lead broker at that new development on Linden Street. You know, the one with the stone columns at the entrance and the big colorful sign. I don't have the address for the house she was showing, but it was in that development. Her boss Lisa can tell you which one. Lisa's name is at the top of the second page, but you'll have to track down her number. Unfortunately, I don't have it. I pass out the glasses of water, and the detective doesn't look at me, but I can sense his judgment. The husband and sister are not friends. The sister is better informed than the husband. Neither reflects well on our marriage. When is the last time either of you talked to Sabine? He says.
I talked to her twice yesterday morning, Ingrid says. The last time was at just before 11. She was on her way to the office. But Jeffrey spoke to her later in the day, in the afternoon.
The lie comes back to me in a flash of icy hot. Ingrid, interrupting my jog, asking to speak to Sabine, me telling Ingrid I'd spoken to Sabine only an hour earlier so I could get back to my run. If I repeat the lie now, it would take the detective all of 2 seconds to catch me in it. One look at my call log would prove me wrong. I sink onto the chair across from Ingrid and shake my head. No, I didn't. I said I talked to Sabine yesterday morning, right before I boarded my connection in Atlanta. I turned to the detective, explaining. I've been in Florida all week at a sales conference. Ingrid's head whips in my direction, and she glares across the table.
When I called you at just before 5, you said you talked to her an hour ago. So around 4.
You must have misunderstood. She presses both hands to the wooden table, and they're shaking.
I heard you loud and clear, Jeffrey. I asked when did you talk to her last, and you said an hour ago.
Do you want to see my call log?
I didn't say that, and I didn't talk to her.
The detective raises both brows, taking a long breath through his nose like a parent might when he's had it with two squabbling toddlers. Okay, let's just back up here for a second. Am I to understand that neither of you talked to her since yesterday morning? Is that correct? I nod.
Yes, that's correct.
Apparently so, Ingrid mumbles. And when you talked to her, did she mention anything out of the ordinary? Maybe that her car was acting funny, or that she had an errand to run in another town? Anything like that? Ingrid and I shake our heads. Finally, something we agree on. And this showing last night. Any idea who it was with? She waits until I shake my head again, then juts a triumphant chin.
I don't know his name, but he was from out of town. Some executive who just started at the Tyson plant. Sabine had found him temporary housing while he searched for a house, an apartment just off 530, but now his wife was coming to town. This showing was more for her than for him. He already loved the house.
I'm silent and also a little shocked. Ingrid's knowledge of her sister's business, all the particulars and detail. Sabine didn't tell me any of this. Or maybe she did. Maybe I just wasn't listening. What else have I missed? Detective Durand consults Ingrid's notes, taps the page with his pen. This Lisa O'Brien will be able to tell me his name? He's no longer directing his questions at me.
I'm sure she can, Ingrid says. In fact, if I had her number, I would have already called to ask. Can you, I don't know, look her up in your system or something?
I'll contact Miss O'Brien, absolutely. I'll also drive by the development and see if anything looks out of the ordinary. I'm not saying it will be. I just want to be sure, to cover all the bases. If I do find any signs of foul play, the words make me twitch like a spider, I'll put a trace on her phone and contact you immediately.
Can you do that now? Trace her phone, I mean? Because if something's happened, if she's hurt, or...
Ingrid shakes her head, swallowing.
I just don't think we should waste any more time.
I'm not going to waste any time, I assure you. A missing person is about as high priority as you can get. And I'm sorry to have to ask this, but has your wife been receiving any threats? Is there anyone out there who might have wanted to hurt her?
No.
I beat Ingrid to the answer this time, but I can't look at her. I keep my gaze, sure and steady, on the detective.
Absolutely not. Everyone loves Sabine. She goes out of her way to be friendly to everyone, partly because that's her job, but mostly because that's just how she is. Friendly and helpful. She's never met a stranger.
Ingrid clears her throat.
It's true. Sabine is a lovely, lovely person.
The detective offers up a smile, but it's neither friendly nor comforting. Okay, I'm going to start by checking the standard places, hospitals, medical centers, jails. I want the two of you to take a look at anything that might give us some insight as to her movements yesterday. Emails, texts, social media pages, mutual bank statements and credit cards, things like that. Compile a list of everything you find and send it to me.
Detective Durand slaps a card to the table, pointing to the number at the bottom. Call me the second Sabine shows up, or if you think of anything else that might be relevant to where she could be. We'll regroup later today.
I nod, mainly because I don't know what else to do. That's it. Interview over. The detective lets himself out, and the two of us sit stunned, staring at each other with wide, horrified eyes. Across from me, Ingrid starts to cry. Now that the detective is gone, I shove Ingrid out the door and put on a pot of coffee. I make it extra strong, the kind that bubbles out opaque and as thick as molasses. Not that I think I'll need the caffeine. Despite my sleepless night, I'm not the least bit drowsy, my veins humming with adrenaline and purpose. If Sabine doesn't show up soon, if somebody doesn't figure out where she went and what happened to her, Ingrid won't be the only one who thinks I had something to do with my wife's disappearance. The detective told me to comb through Sabine's social media and bank accounts, but I was one step ahead of him, already thinking about where Sabine left her laptop. It's an ancient Acer, a thick chunk of plastic and metal as manageable as a cinder block and just as heavy. Its bulk is a big part of the reason why she doesn't usually lug it to work. The other part is that she's got a slick new desk computer at the office, and her iPhone is permanently attached to her palm. But in order to see what she's been up to, I need her login credentials, the ones she keeps in an unprotected Excel file on her desktop. Usernames and passwords for pretty much anything you need a username and password for. Email accounts, bank records, credit card statements. Things that will give me a roadmap to wherever she is, or at the very least, which way she's gone. I start upstairs and work my way down, moving from room to room, looking for her computer, double and triple checking everywhere I can think of. The problem is, Sabine is not logical. She treats her laptop like an old sweater or a pair of shoes, as an afterthought, an item to leave lying around wherever she pleases, half hidden under the bed or the couch. I concentrate my search around the places where Sabine tends to sit. On our bed, the laptop resting on her stretched-out thighs. The left end of the couch, her legs curled under her like a cat. The desk in the study, and the chaise by the window in the den. I peer on shelves and under tables, sift through stacks of papers and books, lift bed skirts and blankets. No laptop. Typical. In each room, before moving on to the next one, I stand in the middle of the floor and call her cell. Even though wherever she is, chances are her phone is with her and not here at home. I hit her number, and then I hold my breath and listen for the familiar melody. Or if it's on silent, the muffled buzzing of it vibrating under a pile of pillows or some clothes. But the only sound is the four lazy beeps right before it goes to voicemail. I hang up and move to the next room. After an hour, I end up back where I started, in the kitchen, empty-handed. I pour myself a cup of thick black sludge and sink onto a bar stool. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe yesterday was one of the rare work days that Sabine needed her computer to search the MLS system or draw up a contract from a coffee shop between showings, in which case I'll have to go to her office to fetch it. That is, assuming she left it there. And it's not sliding around her trunk or on the floorboards of her car. I often see it sticking out of that canvas tote she lugs around, the one I'm forever tripping over when she chucks it by the garage door to search for her keys. I pop off the stool, race to the garage, and there it is, the tote, on the cool cement floor. I snatch it by a handle and carry it inside. The laptop is completely dead. No surprise there. Sabine has needed to replace the battery for ages now, though what she really needs is a new laptop, one that doesn't require almost constant charging. I plug it in under the island counter and turn it on, topping up my coffee while I wait for the thing to power up, which takes forever. I think about Ingrid across town, doing much the same thing, hunched over a laptop in her lonely kitchen, combing her files in search of her twin. I see her red and swollen nose, her hair still frizzy from the pillow, her squinty eyes when she said those ugly words to me. I know what you did to Sabine. And I feel a momentary spurt of fury. And Ingrid thinks I had something to do with this, that I am behind my own wife's disappearance somehow. And the idea makes me want to strangle her. The Acer gives a metallic beep, then lights up with a login screen, a blinking cursor. But there are only so many things her password could be. Sabine's birthday, or mine, our anniversary, combinations of the dates with our names. With every try, the password doc shimmies, but it doesn't let me in. She would choose something that's easy to remember. She doesn't have hobbies, and we don't have pets or children. I try the other people in her life, her mother, followed by her dead father. Still nothing. And then I sigh
and type Ingrid's name and birth date into the bar. The one I should have started with, honestly. And voila! The screen dissolves into her desktop. I email myself the password file from Sabine's email program that is a giant honking mess. More than 20,000 unread messages. Everything from stores to spam to requests for viewing automatically generated emails from the MLS and REMAX systems. It would take days to search through the chaos for anything remotely relevant, especially since I'm not even sure what I'm looking for. Instead, I flip to the sent messages and start at the top. Contracts, sales pitches, the usual stuff. After the one I just sent, the most recent message is from Tuesday, now 2 days ago. I exit and head to Facebook. Sabine has some 3,000 friends, most of whom aren't friends at all. Clients, colleagues, people from Rotary and business clubs. I go to her profile page, scrolling through post after post boasting sales numbers and pictures of homes listed and sold. No wonder she's always on her phone, her pretty thumbs flying across the keyboard like a teenager's. Her Facebook page is a walking advertisement for her services, her success. Halfway down, I pause on a video from last week, a Facebook Live clip featuring a newly built house on Longmeadow Street. I'm shocked at the number below it. A counter boasting 758 views. Sabine is one of the top brokers, but still, that many? I click on the video, and the counter ticks to 759. The video loads, and there she is, my AWOL wife. She's wearing her favorite summer dress, the yellow one with the ruffles around the hem, and the gold locket I gave her last Christmas, dangling from a chain around her neck. Her hair, pulled high into a ponytail, flicks cheerfully when she talks, bobbing over a tan shoulder. "Hey, y'all, Sabine Hardison here with the most fabulous house in the block," she laughs. "Okay, so I know I say that about every house, but this one really is the most fabulous I've seen in, like, ever. 4 humongous bedrooms, 5.5 baths. Yes, people, you heard that right, a full bath for every bedroom, and a master suite you have to see to believe. Let's take a look, shall we?" She looks happy. Her skin is flushed, her cheeks pink with excitement as she backward walks the camera through the house, pointing out the features. When she signed up for the real estate course in Little Rock, I bitched about the time commitment. Didn't hold back about how the house and our social life and our marriage would suffer. But I knew she'd be good at it. The truth is, that's what I was more worried about. I leaned forward on my chair, remembering when she used to smile like this at me, when I was the one to make her glow. The computer beeps, and at the bottom of the screen, a window opens, a message from someone named Bella. "Hey, you, I ran into Trevor last night at the grocery store, and he was asking about you, like really asking, if I've seen you lately, if we talked, what we talked about. He wouldn't tell me why, just gave me this big-ass smile like a canary would pop out any second. Are you the canary? I'm here for you whenever you have something to tell me. XO. I sit back on my stool. Trevor. Who the fuck is Trevor? I click on the list of Sabine's friends and type the name in the search bar with 0 results. I repeat the search in her email program, and this time I get a hit. Multiple hits, actually. Messages sent and received with Dr. Trevor McAdams, an OBGYN at Jefferson Regional. Apparently, Sabine sold him a house last fall. The most recent string is a boring exchange from November, setting up a meeting for the signing of papers, the official exchange of keys. I scan their back and forth, but there's nothing out of the ordinary. No flirtatious innuendo, nothing that implies a swallow-the-canary kind of outcome. The only thing Trevor says that is even remotely personal is that he wishes her a nice Thanksgiving. She thanks him, says she hopes he and his family will be happy in their new home. His family. Maybe I'm overthinking this. Trevor is an OBGYN, so it's not entirely impossible he could be Sabine's doctor. Not because she's pregnant. Something that's impossible when you haven't had sex in 5. That's right, count 'em, 5 months. But women go to the gynecologist for other reasons. Maybe Sabine goes to this guy. I scroll down to his signature, click through to his bio on the hospital website. Trevor McAdams is a decent-looking guy, probably somewhere in his early 40s. Clear skin, bright eyes, full head of hair swept off a broad forehead. The type of face that plenty of women wouldn't mind having between their legs. Is my wife one of them? I return to the emails and open one of the attachments. 8 months ago, Trevor plunked down just over $300,000 for 4,572 square feet of newly renovated house on a quiet street overlooking Pine Bluff Country Club. That's a lot of square footage, and an address in the swankiest area of town. No mortgage, which means he earns a hell of a lot more than Sabine and I do added together. I jot his address on a sticky note, 1600 Country Club Lane. I open Sabine's calendar and search her the address for last night's showing. But it's empty. She hasn't synced it in ages. Maybe never. I click the icon for the internet instead and surf to Google, where Sabine has already signed in. I pause, the cursor hovering over the symbol for Gmail. Sabine has a Gmail account? I stop, stare at the screen, breathe hard and fast through my nose. My fingers linger over the trackpad because I know, I goddamn it, all to hell know what I'll find once I click it. Hundreds of IM chats, all with Trevor McFuckin' Adams. I need to see you, even if it's only for a minute. I'm sitting next to him, thinking about you. Meet me at our place in half an hour. You said we wouldn't fall in love. You lied. I'm glad. I'm ready to tell them, Sabine. I'm ready to take that step whenever you are. OMG, are we really going to do this? Can we? Yes, damn it. All you have to do is say the word. I love you. Let's tell them this weekend. The coffee turns to oil in my stomach, and I shove the cup away. It skids across the counter and into the sink, and it's a good thing Sabine is not here, because if she were, I would fucking kill her. Nah, first I would hurt her, and then I would hurt Trevor, and then I would kill them both. No wonder he swallowed the fucking canary. For the past however many months, he's been having secret sexcapades with my wife while I played the role of clueless, foolish, idiot, ignorant husband. Somewhere across town, a bitch named Bella is laughing at me. Is that where Sabine is right now? In a bed somewhere? With him? My gaze lands on the sticky note. 1600 Country Club Lane. 10 minutes later, I'm death-gripping the wheel of my car, the pedal punched to the floor.
Marcus. This case I handle by the book. I start at the show house, walking the grounds and studying the dirt for imprints, both shoes and tires. I press my face to the windows and peer into all the rooms. This place is a show house, all right. Every room packed with complicated, flashy furniture, every horizontal surface crammed with bowls and candles and crap. I try the doors, the latches on the windows, but the place is locked up tight. No sign anyone but a decorator has been here. From there, I go to the office for a face-to-face with Sabine's boss, Lisa, a perfumed blonde in a ruby-red suit with lips to match. According to her, not only was Sabine a no-show for last night's showing, she also missed a company-wide training yesterday afternoon where she was supposed to present on building a social media platform. "You don't understand," Lisa tells me, a frown pulling on her Botoxed brow. "Sabine is my hardest worker, and she's always on time for everything, especially showings. Honestly, Detective, this is very worrisome. This isn't like her at all." The other brokers I talk to say much the same. Sabine is responsible, considerate, punctual. Like Lisa, they're worried something happened. An accident, maybe, or worse. Could she have booked a last-minute vacation? I ask every one of them. Maybe she needed to get away for a day or two. Head shakes all around. I'm on my way to the station to write up a report when my phone rings. Bryn. My reaction is both instant and physical. I wince. My lungs deflate like an unleashed balloon. 3 years since her husband passed, my former partner, and her calls still hit me like a punch to the gut. Stifling a groan, I pick up on the hands-free system. Hey, Bryn. Hi, Marcus. Do you have a minute? She sniffs, and I know it's not going to be a minute. Pretty much the last thing I have time for right now. I need to get my ass to the department. I need to plug Sabine's name through all the available databases, make sure Chief Eubank sees my hard-working face. I need to make it known around the department that I met the missing woman once when she showed my wife and me a house, so there's no uncomfortable questions down the road. I need to get every cop on the street watching for her car. But once upon a time, I made a promise to Brian and to God to watch over his sons, to be there for their birthdays and school graduations, to make sure they go to church and stay out of trouble. They're two little hellions, but I love them like they're my own. The only problem is, I'm not so crazy about his widow, Bryn. Scratch that. It's not that I don't like Bryn, it's that I don't always agree with her parenting methods. She babies those boys, lets them get away with far too much, and without a man in the house to counteract her coddling, her boys have the run of the place. She's constantly calling me to bellyache, how they're walking all over her, how they could use a good talking to. My wife, Emma, says it's a cry for adult male interaction, in this case, mine, for someone to shoulder the burden like Brian used to. Emma's not the best armchair psychologist, but in this case, I think she might be right. Bryn sighs into the phone. I was cleaning up Timmy's room just now, and I found a whole bunch of toys I've never seen before. Those spinners, you know, the ones all the kids are flinging around these days, and a whole bunch of other stuff that's not his. The problem is, I didn't buy it, and there's no way he could have bought it all himself. First of all, he'd need me to drive him to the store, which I didn't do. And toys are expensive. How'd he afford so many on a dollar a week allowance? You think he stole them? I hate thinking that about my own son, but I don't know what else it could be. He didn't get them from me, that's for sure. She pauses, giving me time to make the offer, to tell her I'm on my way. He talks to you, Marcus. He tells you things he won't say to me. I don't have time for this. I'm almost to the station, and backtracking to her house will tack on a half hour, maybe more, of driving time alone. And visits to Bryn are never quick. They involve tearful conversations and awkward hugs, endless pep talks and bottomless glasses of sweet tea. I do not have time. But I think of Brian, and I can't say no. I beat a fist on the wheel, then jerk it hard to the left, making a U-turn in the middle of the road. I'll be right over. 12 minutes later, I skid to a stop in front of the house, a squat ranch that's seen better days. The grass needs mowing, the window frames could use a fresh coat of paint, and I count at least a half dozen shingles missing on the roof. I shake my head, shake it off. Not my responsibility, no time. I'm coming up the walkway when the front door opens and Bryn steps outside. She's lost more weight since the last time she called me here, less than a month ago, and it looks like she's gotten even less sleep than I did. Pale skin, eye bags, the works. She likes to joke that her kids are trying to kill her, and not for the first time I wonder if it might be true. Thanks for coming, she says. I didn't know what to do. Who else to call? How about her father, who lives just up the road? Brian's brother in the next town, or any one of the other 15 detectives who stood behind her when she buried her husband. I'm not just her first resort. As far as I can tell, I'm the only one. I meant my promise to Brian, but in moments like these, I sure wish she'd let the other men in her life help, too. I drop a kiss on her cheek, which is cold and pasty. How's he doing? Pouting, upstairs in his room. I pat her shoulder and step inside, taking the stairs by twos. Timmy's door, the last at the end of the hall, is closed, but I'm pretty sure he's not pouting. Video game sounds are coming through the wood, a car race by the sound of it. I rap the door with a knuckle. Yo, Timmy, it's me, Marcus. Timmy is the oldest boy, a wiry kid with his father's cowlick and a half-decent jump shot. He was only 4 when his father died, a bullet to the chest at a routine traffic stop. I heard the pop, looked up, and Brian was on the ground, the kid who shot him running away. He's currently serving life in prison, but the point is, Timmy barely remembers his father. He only remembers me stepping into his father's shoes. When he doesn't answer, I open the door, lean my head inside. I take it you know why I'm here. Timmy is sprawled on his bed in sweatpants and bare feet, and he looks up with a sheepish expression. In my mind, another strike against his mother. She only calls when one of her kids needs disciplining, which is all the damn time. If she's the pushover, I'm the bad guy, the strict, well, not parent, but certainly disciplinarian. I'd much prefer the role of cool godfather. Yeah, I know why. Timmy's gaze goes back to the TV, and his thumb works the joystick in his hands. On the television screen, his car, a bright green Mustang, is tearing up a dirt track. I step inside, shut the door behind me. You want to explain it to me, then? He shakes his head. Uh-uh. Come on, Timmy. Either you turn the game off, or I will. Timmy sighs, but he hits pause. He stares at his lap as the room falls into silence. I sink onto the edge of his bed. So, here's the thing. There's a woman missing, and for about, I check my watch, do the math, 20 hours now. The most crucial hours in an investigation, and the farther out we get from the time of disappearance, the less likely it is I'll find this woman in time. I shouldn't even be here right now, but I am because you're important to me, too. He looks up, a lightning-quick glance. You think the woman's dead? I should have known he'd latch on to that part. That's what happens when you lose a parent at such an early age. You have an unnatural preoccupation with death and dying. But Timmy is smart, and he knows when someone is lying to him. I'll tell you what, buddy, it's not looking good.
Oh.
Yeah, oh. I drape a hand over his scrawny leg, give it a jiggle. So help me out here, will you? Tell me where you got the toys. Timmy tosses the joystick on the bed and reaches over, pulling a notebook from his bedside table. He flips it to a page smothered in writing, big, sloppy letters and numbers lined up in crooked columns. I scan the page, taking in the list of names and toys. A logbook. You've been trading your toys and games?
Yeah, but only for a little while. We were going to trade back after we're done playing with them, only Mom took everything and now I can't. That's why I kept a list. So I wouldn't forget where all my stuff went.
I toss the notebook to the bed, biting down on a grin. This kid may be a hellion, but he's not a thief. In fact, he's actually kind of brilliant. Whether he realizes it or not, this kid just created a co-op. Okay. But you do realize if you just told your mom all of this, you could have saved me a trip. Timmy frowns, folding his scrawny arms across his chest like I said something wrong. I'm trying to figure out what when my cell buzzes, and I check the screen. A text from Rick, another detective on the force. Hospitals, med centers, jails, and morgues, all clean. No sign of car, no activity on phone either. I type out a reply, on my way, be there in 15, and slide it back into my pocket. Listen, I need you to promise me two things. Timmy, look at me. I wait for him to meet my gaze, then I stick a thumb in the air. First, that you'll tell your mom the truth about the toys. Explain it to her like you did me. Show her the list. Your mom's a smart woman and she loves you. She'll think you're as smart as I do for coming up with such a plan. Do you think you can do that? He gives me a reluctant nod. I uncurl a finger, hold it alongside my thumb. And second, next time you want to see me, just pick up the phone and call. It's a hell of a lot easier for everybody involved. Way better than getting yourself in trouble just so I'll come over. The look he gives me tells me I was right. His mother is not the only one in this family looking for a little male influence. The boys need it just as much. I resolve to be better, to do better. I ruffle his hair and stand. As soon as this case is behind me, we'll do something fun, just you and me, okay? A movie, a ball game, you pick. Does that sound all right to you? Timmy looks up from his bed and smiles. That sounds awesome. Now get up here and give me a hug so I can go. It's the fastest hug on record, as is my trek down the stairs. Bryn is waiting for me at the bottom, her expression hopeful and disappointed at the same time. I'm not staying. That much is clear from the way I hit the floor and keep going, heading in long strides to the door. Talk to Timmy, he promised to explain. My phone buzzes. Rick again, with a possible sighting of Sabine's car. Shit.
Are you sure you can't stay?
Bryn says. Call you later, I say, and then I'm off like a shot, jogging across the front yard to my car.
Death. I roll up at a two-story cottage on the west side and double-check the address. 1071 English Street. I take in the salmon-painted siding, white picket fencing, the neat manicured front lawn lined with a cheerful border of impatiens. On the outside, at least, Morgan House is a dream. 100 times better than the shithole on Wiley Street. And that's without even taking into account the hooker. I park at the curb, sling my bag over my shoulder, and head for the door. The woman who pulls it open is large. Amazonian large, with a stretched-out frame and limbs like a panther, lean and miles long. The tallest woman I've ever seen, though. My gaze lands on her throat. Not even a shadow of Adam's apple. She steps onto the porch in 4-inch heels, and I have to tip my head all the way back to look at her. Can I help you? Her voice is round and resonant, like she's talking into an empty jug. I clear my throat and smile. Yes, I'm looking for whoever's in charge of this place. Well then, you're in luck, 'cause you found her. She sticks out a hand the size of a skillet. Her nails are pointy and sharp, painted a shiny hot pink. My name's Miss Sally, and you are? Her makeup is immaculate, if a little heavy. Fuchsia lips, lined and shaded lids, a pinkish bronze lining her cheekbones. I search her chin for tiny pinpricks of whiskers. It's too early to have a shadow, but still. And find nothing. Her foundation looks spray-painted on, dense but flawless. Beth Murphy, I say, shaking her hand. A friend gave me this address because I'm looking for... You don't look like a Beth. She leans back and studies me, her gaze exploring my face, my hair, my suspiciously dark eyebrows, which I didn't think to color until it was too late. You look more like a Haley, or maybe a Madeline. I go ice cold and overheated all at once. I don't look like a Beth. I don't feel like one either. My baggy clothes, my dollar store hair are all wrong. I've only been Beth for a day, and already I can feel her slipping away. Miss Sally laughs, slapping me playfully on an arm. I'm just playing around with you, sugar. In my house, you can be whoever you want to be. Now, come on in, and I'll show you around. I step inside the tiny foyer, and she shuts the door behind me. A TV blares from the room to my left, a square space crammed with mismatched couches and chairs. A table, some bookshelves. The only occupant is a man in dusty jeans and a yellow hard hat. He looks over from his perch on the couch and lifts his chin in a greeting. Living room, TV room, and study all in one, Miss Sally says. Those books there are loaners, meaning don't go leaving them all over town or selling them off to Goodwill. There's cards, darts, and board games in the cupboard. The Wi-Fi is free, but the vending machines aren't. Parkin is out back. Looks great, I say. But I'm talking to air. Miss Sally is already halfway down a long, narrow hallway. I hustle to catch up, peeking into the bedrooms as we pass. Tiny, but neat. A single bed, a dresser, and not much else. So, Beth, she says, stopping, turning on the hallway runner to face me. Did you just get to town? Yes, today, in fact. How are you liking Atlanta so far? It's okay. There's a lot of traffic. She laughs, though it's not even remotely funny. It's also jungle hot, sprawled halfway to Tennessee, and has entirely too many Republicans. But it's not all that bad, you'll see. You on your own? Very. Where from? Out west. She twitches a brow that says she wants more. You're a great liar. For years I've watched you tell the truth whenever possible, and not embellish with too much detail you'll only forget later. Lies multiply, contradict, proliferate. Sticking to something close to the truth is the only way for you to keep track of all your lies, to keep them from piling up and you from stumbling over the simplest answers. I follow your example now. I'm not really from anywhere, not anymore anyway. I move around a lot. It's enough for Miss Sally. She turns on her heels, raps on a door with a knuckle. We've got 3 bathrooms, she says, shoving the door open. 1 for every 4 bedrooms, and they pretty much all look like this one. She steps aside so I can see. 2 pedestal sinks, a toilet, and at the far end, a glass-enclosed shower. Utilitarian and blinding white. The room smells clean, like Old Spice and bleach. Shower time is 3 minutes. Seems short, I know, but you can get everything you need to get done in that time if you're efficient. And if you're not, well, we know what you're doing in there. And you do not want to be going over. People start pounding on the door at 2:59, and they won't be polite about it either. Bitches who hog the hot water aren't so popular around here, I can promise you that. It's very neat. No toothbrushes, no sticky tubes of cream or paste, no forgotten towels on the floor. The place is spotless. Miss Sally gives me a nod that says she's pleased I noticed. That's because anything you leave behind gets confiscated. If not by me, then by whoever goes in after you. Don't leave your shit lying around. That's one of the house rules. What are the others? She ticks them off on jolly green giant fingers. No smoking, no drugs, no sleepovers. And if you're not in the door by midnight, you'll be sleeping on the lawn. Other than that, just don't be an asshole, and you'll do fine. Does that mean I'm in? In lieu of an answer, she turns and moves farther down the hall. Kitchen's down there, and the laundry room is in the basement. $1 a load, drop it in the lockbox on the wall. We live by the honor code here, and don't even think of stiffing me. I'm not saying I have cameras everywhere, but it's best to assume I have cameras everywhere. I start at the word cameras, and my gaze wanders to the ceiling, searching out the corners. Miss Sally laughs, a big sound that fills the hallway like a cello chorus. Well, I'm not going to be that obvious about it now, am I? I can't tell if she's fucking with me or not. And the price? Single rooms are $24 a night. Rent is due in cash on Sundays at noon. No exceptions. Come to me either short or late, and you're out. A few bucks more than Wiley Street, but also a million times nicer. I nod. She looks down her nose at me, and the silence that fills the hallway tightens the skin of my stomach. She's waiting for something, and so am I. For her to pose the question I've been dreading since I walked through the door. Can you prove you are who you say you are? She opens her mouth, and my heart gives a sudden kick. Who is this friend you mentioned earlier? I shake my head, confused. I'm sorry, what? When you knocked on my door, you said a friend gave you the address. Who? Tell me his or her name. I think about how Beth should answer, if she's the type of person to lie easily and effortlessly, like you. The opposite of old me, who's never been a natural liar, though I've certainly sharpened my skills some. Don't change your voice. Don't fidget or become too still. Hold a steady, confident gaze. And whatever you do, don't look up and to the left. But now I've waited too long to answer. The dreaded toot-telling pause. It's too late to blurt out a name and hope for the best, and my gut tells me this is some kind of test. That Miss Sally, with her third-degree tone and squinty eyes, would see straight through me. So maybe friend was too big a word, I say, lifting an apologetic shoulder. Maybe it was more like some random person I met at Best Buy. Miss Sally's shiny lips spread in a grin. Girl, welcome to Morgan House. I celebrate securing a new room by falling onto the bed fully clothed and conking out for 5 hours straight. It's still light when I awaken, but the sun is dipped below the trees, giant pines that sway in the air above my window. My few belongings are tucked in the drawer to my right, an easy arm's reach for my bed. When Miss Sally shoved open my door, she handed me two keys, one for the door and the second for the drawer. But if she's the type to spy with secret hidden cameras, then she's also the type to have a master key. My dwindling wad of cash is strapped to a belt inside my shirt. Somewhere below me, people are starting to trickle in. The front door opens and closes, and voices worm up through the floor like distant waves. I wonder about the proper etiquette here. Do I go down and say hello? Stay in my room. I hear a sudden burst of laughter, and I am overcome with uncertainty. Venturing downstairs means talking to people, introducing myself as Beth, answering questions like the ones Miss Sally asked. Up here in my room behind my closed door, I am invisible. My stomach growls, and I unlock the drawer and dig out a small bag of peanuts, the last one. I rip off the corner and think what I really want is a burger, dripping in grease and draped in bacon, smothered in mayonnaise and ketchup, and a thick layer of pickles. My mouth waters, and I remember all those times I ate pickles at the fair, giant, foil-wrapped mammoths my sister and I had to hold in both hands. We'd wander among the bumper cars and farm stalls, eating them until our stomachs ached. You say pickles make my breath stink. Tomorrow, I'm going to buy a jar of Vlasics and eat every single one. For someone who is trying to shed herself of a husband, I sure do think of you a lot. Part of it is habit. All those years of tiptoeing around your moods and catering to your every whim are hard to unlearn, like a Charles Manson brainwashing. And it's still a necessary measure to keep myself safe. I have to think of you, to imagine the steps you're taking to find me in order to stay one step in front of you. But I can't stay up here, hiding in my room forever. I reach for my phone, pull up the calculator. At $24 a night, my $2,000 stash will last me only a couple of months. And that's assuming the pile of crap car Dill sold me doesn't blow a fuse or a tire. And Beth has to eat, which means Beth needs to do some seriously creative thinking. Even a job slinging burgers requires some sort of identification. I turn the peanut bag upside down over my mouth, but all I get is crumbs. I toss the bag on the bed. Groceries and a job. That's on the agenda for tomorrow. I think about what you're doing now, some 30 hours into my disappearing trick. I wonder if you found my car, my cell phone, the clues that will lead you to Tulsa, the opposite direction of here. I picture you searching through my things, calling my sister and my friends, combing through the files on my computer, and my senses go on high alert. I listen for the rumble of your car, the scrape of your key in the door, the tremor of your heavy shoes coming down the hallway floor. I shoot a glance to the window, half expecting to see the pale moon of your face peering in, the flash of your gotcha smile, before you point your gun at my head. My heart taps a double time and I take deep belly breaths, trying to calm my nervous system. Post-traumatic stress is no joke. Flashbacks and nightmares and anxiety attacks like this one are the product of years of abuse. It'll take more than a couple days of freedom for my body to uncoil. Freedom. I'm not there yet. Not even close. I'm more in danger now than that time the waiter accidentally brushed his fingers against mine when refilling my water, or any one of the times you came home after a particularly bad day at work. Leaving does not stop the violence, and it doesn't guarantee freedom. Why doesn't she just leave? Gets asked in living rooms and courtrooms across the country, when a better question would be, why doesn't he let her go? It took me a while, but I've finally figured out the answer. You'd sooner kill me than let me go.
Jeffrey. On a long stretch of stick-straight road, 1600 Country Club Lane is tucked behind a thick tuft of trees and bushes. I don't see it until I've already blown past. Then I slam the brakes and screech to a stop in the middle of the road. Because what the hell? Nobody's on this street but me. And with any luck, the squealing of my tires lets them know I'm here, that I'm coming in. I throw the car into reverse, pulling into the driveway in a sloppy arc, my gaze lighting on an upstairs window. I picture the two of them popping up in bed behind the shiny glass, sheets pressed to their naked, panting chests. I'm here, bitches. Just in case, I lean on the horn. The house is a renovated bungalow, sprawling and ivy-colored, the kind of place Sabine would go gaga over. A pompous thing that belongs in the rolling hills of Tuscany, not pressed up against the faded greens of the Pine Bluff Country Club. An easy sale, a house she'd already be in love with before Trevor walked through the door. I climb out of the car and slam my door with a sharp clap that echoes down the street. Inside the house, a little dog barks, high-pitched and frantic. Good. At least somebody knows I'm here. I stomp up the walkway and bang on the front door with a fist. Sabine! I know you're in there, so open up! Open this door right goddamn now! The fury fills me like a furnace, bathing my body in a thin layer of sweat. Somewhere inside this stupid, pretentious house, my wife's body is wrapped around her lover's, and if one of them doesn't open this door right fucking now, I'm gonna bust it down with my bare hands. I cup my hands around my face and lean into the glass, searching for movement, but all I see is an empty foyer. I haul back a fist and bang some more. On either side of me, two gas-fueled porch lights flicker in the fading light. 2 feet appear at the top of the stairs. Male feet, sticking out from under blue scrubs. The man comes down, trailed by a tiny white dog that is losing its shit. Each frantic bark pops all four of his paws off the ground, a fluffy jumping bean bouncing down the stairs. But it's Trevor, all right. A shirtless Trevor. I recognize him from his headshot. Full head of hair, strong shoulders that taper down into the abs of a movie star. Not an ounce of fat or love handles on him. Not that I would normally notice such a thing. But Sabine would. She'd notice, and then she'd want to trace all those sculpted muscles with her fingertips. And maybe her tongue. It's you, he says, studying me through the door's paned windows. All those years of hospital training, of on-call shifts and middle-of-the-night births, are working now like a Xanax, making him look almost bored at the prospect of his lover's husband banging on his front door. I beat on the wood hard enough to crack it. Where's Sabine? Tell that little bitch to stop hiding and get her ass down here! On the other side of the glass, the dog is going ballistic. Trevor scoops it up and cradles it to his chest like a football. His mouth is moving, but I can't hear his words over the barking and the doorbell, which I'm mashing over and over and over again with a thumb. He opens the door with a whoosh of cool air and moneyed manliness. I'm sorry, Jeffrey, but Sabine's not here. Jeffrey, I've known about this motherfucker's existence for less than half an hour, and now he's calling me by my first name. Did Sabine show him my picture? Did they laugh about poor, clueless Jeffrey and talk about the best way to make me look like a fool? I shove him out of the way, marching to the stairs and hollering up them. Sabine, you can come out now. I saw the emails. I know. Jeffrey. A hand lands on my shoulder. Calm down. She's not here. I shrug him off, swinging my arm through the air. You touch me again, Trevor, and I will shove my fist down your throat hard enough to come out the other side. Do you understand what I'm telling you? The dog kicks things up a notch, or 10, barking so hard he's starting to foam at the mouth. Trevor holds a chill-out hand in my direction, and wraps his fingers around the dog's snoot like a muzzle. Finally, thankfully, the beast stops barking. Where is she? I'm not looking at him, but beyond him into the foyer. A family's foyer. Kids' shoes, a soccer ball, forgotten jackets and book bags. I wonder if Sabine has met them yet. If they hate her for blowing their happy home to bits. Trevor shuts the door. I already told you she's not here. Why should I believe you? You shouldn't. But I'm telling you the God's honest truth that she's not upstairs. I'd let you look, but my kids are up there. He winces. Jesus, I'm going to have to explain this to them, aren't I? They're only 6 and 4. They're never going to understand. If that was an attempt to make me feel sorry for him, it gets him nowhere. I don't give a shit about his kids or the fissure in his family. I only care about mine. You fucked my wife. A normal person would deny it, especially one who's just been threatened with a fist down his throat. But not Trevor. His shoulders slump, and he sighs, and his body language just lays it all out there. Yes, yes, now that you mention it, I did fuck your wife. He even has the balls to look apologetic. Look, if it makes you feel any better, we didn't want you to find out like this. Sabine was going to tell you to your face this weekend. Ask her. She'll tell you we had it all planned out. She was going to tell you the right way. The right way? What in the fucking hell?